armor that those gentlemen were wearing, which is why they walked around rather clumsily and took so many shots from so many high-powered rifles. It's virtually impossible to penetrate this type of armor, which is easily available to anybody. That incident tended to mark me psychologically as a police officer, because you expect people to stop shooting when they get hit the first time. Unfortunately, it didn't occur. In closing, I'd just like to say that I'm taking some quotes here, that vests have become the protection of choice for gang members and career criminals. They're viewed as status symbols, and police see body armor on young people more and more, and there is a gray market developing as this demand increases. These quotes are from Portland television channel, KOIN, Channel 6. I noted them in an article that they produced in 1998, and the quotes came from members of the Portland Police Bureau. That was in 1998. Gang members are readily turning to this as a means of extending their ability at a scene to either gun down a rival gang member or to fight off police officers. And I certainly hope that you give this bill very consider your closest consideration. Thank you.
Right.
Chairman Minister, if I may add one thing more. I have proposed an amendment, Senate Bill 133-1 in Gross. It changes the original proposed bill to include armor which protects from against stabbing implements, knife stabbings, and that sort of thing. And that's essentially what it does.
Okay.
I await your questions.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In light of the comments that were made before about people who might have a nonviolent felony in their background that might have some cause to need body armor, not for the commission of crime, but perhaps for other purposes, how would you feel about narrowing the scope of this particular provision to this statute to include just those convicted of violent felonies?
Well, I'm not really sure how I would feel about it. At this point, I would say in general, when we look at the existing law that prohibits felons from being in possession of firearms, prohibits them from convicted felons, from being in possession of certain prohibited weapons. When you've been convicted of a felon, once you've been convicted of a felony, you give up certain rights. And I think this would just be an addition to that. This is not preventing the general public from wearing body armor. It's targeting one segment of our population, the society, that's already been addressed, and this would be an attachment. I would have some empathy for that group, but I would also say under those circumstances, with all the social services and I think programs out there, there might be other ways to address that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, if I could. I don't have an objection to the amendment if it's a reasonable one that addresses that category of nonviolent felons. Having been in the district attorney's office and prosecuted a fair number of C felony failure to pay child support in a timely manner cases, I think that category of individual probably could avail themselves of body armor under certain circumstances. And as Ingrid so succinctly outlined, there may be other occasions people who have a non-violent driving while suspended or something felony on that who may be entitled or need protection under certain circumstances. And if an amendment is necessary in order to bring this protection to our police community and to our citizens on the street, then I would be more than happy to consider a friendly amendment.
Further questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For any of you, I would share Senator Burdick's concerns just initially, trying to think of unintended consequences. Certainly your intent, I wholeheartedly endorse, but I was curious about your amendment, and one of the exceptions that you would propose would be while a person is being transported accompanied by a peace officer.
Correct.
And I was thinking in terms of you know, witness protection. I mean, there are some cases in which they're not being transported, but they're very key to they may be subject to that type of a threat, and they're needed by the law enforcement community as a witness, and that would not be covered under here. Would that be an area that we might want to extend that as well?
Generally, if a witness is so sensitive, it has been my experience, Senator Menas, Chair through Senator Metzger.
I can get confusing.
I'll get it right. Senator Metzger through the Chair, Senator Menas. Generally, if a witness is that sensitive, they are being escorted by a police officer under those circumstances. And if they need special leave of the court to have protection or something like that, I know it would be availing upon a simple motion to the court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Hearing none.
I appreciate comments? Thank you very much for your for the opportunity to present this.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative. And let's see, we have a number of people who have come, looks like over 100 miles, and I'm assuming they want to chat together. It's Chuck Hayes, Jim Harper, Bob Wolf, and Vernon Wells. Am I assuming you all want to talk together at the same time? Come on up if you will. Gentlemen, if you would, just introduce yourself and then begin your testimony.
Chair Menas, members of the committee, for the record, we represent the Oregon State Police, Captain Chuck Hayes, Chief of Police, Vern Wells. My name is Jim Harper. I'm the police chief from Dallas Police Department, and we have Sheriff Bob Wolf from Polk County.
Okay, gentlemen.
Chair Menas, after looking at this particular proposal, all the associations, including the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon Sheriff's Association and the State Police, are all in agreement that this is a good legislation. It makes a lot of sense, and it's a simple piece of legislation that I think can do some good out on the street for police officers. I've heard testimony that that the use of body armor is defensive in nature. I can argue against that I think a lot of times in situations where it's worn by felons that it would be offensive in nature for only one purpose, and that's to defeat standard police tactics, and of which you've already seen some of the results of that nationwide in several shootings where standard police tactics weren't enough to stop people that were trying to use deadly physical force against citizens and also against police officers. From our point of view, this particular legislation standardizes restrictions on felons, and it makes a lot of sense. I would be glad to have any of us answer questions as far as perspectives or whatever.
Okay, good. Questions? Senator Burdick?
Thank you. Have you given any thought to whether this goes far enough to do the purpose for which it's intended, in other words, to keep people from who want to commit a crime from having the advantage against your tactics? And what I'm mainly concerned about is the subject of perhaps gangs, where perhaps there isn't a felony conviction, but someone is still using this body armor. I probably should have asked the previous panel the same thing, but do you have any thoughts on that, whether this is adequate to the task?
Chair Menas, Senator Burdick, I think that a lot of times we have to kind of take it one step at a time, and I think that this is probably the first place to start. And if And if we have situations where these particular items are used during the commissions of crimes, then I think maybe we could look at that in the future also as a particular violation of law.
Could you, for my help, what was your question again?
The question was whether it will solve the problem if it's limited to convicted felons. In other words, there are gang situations where maybe gang members who are participating in a crime don't have felony convictions.
Where the vest is used for the purpose of overcoming.
Exactly.
Police. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not a police officer, the chair is, and I know like they have the training academy or West Oregon University where I work. In police work, when you are armed, when you're trained from day one and you have to draw your weapon, and if should you ever have to use it, I know that that's the last thing you want to do. When you fire that that particular revolver or weapon, are you trained to, if at all possible, to strike or aim it at a certain part of the body initially or first? Is there, and I don't know this, I'm really asking a question, Mr. Chair, to find for something for the record. I think I'm
Chairman, as Senator Courtney, I'm also a firearms instructor at the police academy. What we teach is that the officers are trained to shoot for the largest available target or center of mass at the time to obviously deal with the situation. So if you think about it, the use of body armor would obviously allow to defeat that particular training.
Correct, Mr. Chair. What I was trying to point out is those who might say, well, a headshot, that is not what your training is all about, is it? That's why this bill is so critical in a sense.
Chairman and Senator Courtney, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The other three gentlemen, comments, testimony?
Yes, Senator Minnis, Chairman Minnis, I would like to add...
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, what's that?
Could you identify yourself?
Vern Wells with the Independence Police Department and speaking for the Chiefs Association. One of the things we haven't spoke to yet is the fact that in the last few years, most of our agencies have purchased less lethal weapons. We're spending a lot of money to acquire that kind of equipment and to train our people. And again, it will be defeated by someone wearing a vest, because again, it's used center of mass.
Do you want to tell us what less lethal weapons are?
These are like beanbag guns, rubber ball guns, things that... Tasers, any of those kinds of weapons that would allow us to control a situation without the use of deadly force will be minimized or completely eliminated if the person we're confronting is wearing a vest.
All right. Question, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess you've confused me with that, because I thought that a beanbag gun or rubber bullets were intended to simply knock a person down. Would this vest prevent that from happening?
It certainly should, yes, sir.
Okay. Senator Courtney, another question?
Probably just the felons.
The bill as written applies only to convicted felons, yes. Is that what you're saying?
Not to spread it all over the entire world. Have you had discussions as to why, I mean, if you're going to commit a crime where there's real danger, forcing the police maybe to have to use deadly force, why did you choose just felons? I mean, what's that for, as opposed to anybody?
Seemed like a good idea at the time, I think. No.
I'm not trying to play games. I'm just saying, if whether someone's called a felon or not, they have this on, and it's getting tough. There isn't going to be any distinction out there when it's getting, you understand my point. So I'm just sort of curious why, from a historical perspective, why you chose, if you're a felon, no, if you're not a felon, decide you want to hit the bank, you can wear this thing. It's not going to be a crime to wear this thing. And I'm just not trying to be funny. Why? Hello? Something wrong?
Chairman, Senator Courtney, I think I follow on your question. As far as, are you talking about the use of different tactics, or are you talking about why somebody would decide to wear body armor that's a felon?
I think he's arguing that the bill is too narrow.
I understand it. If you're a felon, you have a record as a felon, and you put this on, you've committed a crime. That's a crime. It's all right to wear this stuff. Otherwise, is that right? Even if you're going to commit a crime, that's okay?
Yeah, Chairman, Senator Courtney, that's correct. At this particular, according to this legislation, it would be, today it is completely allowed for anybody to wear body armor.
Right. And this would say a felon can't wear body armor per se. How about somebody who's not a felon, puts on body armor, and then just, and is going to, for the purposes of committing a crime and making it tougher on you people to do your job? What are your thoughts on that?
Chair Menace, Senator Cardiner, I think Senator Burdick also asked a similar question. And,
I'm sorry.
And I think in response also to her is that this particular legislation was a first step.
Okay.
Far as any particular amendments, I think that's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm. Senator Courtney is the only member of the bar on the committee, and I'm sure that we could probably tap his ability to help amend this if the committee desires.
Yes. So,
I kind of agree with where Senator Courtney's going.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yeah. I got Representative Lowe back here who's raising her hand, and then Mr. Brian DeLashman who's also raising his hand, and you gentlemen, if you don't mind, we'll bring them up and have them just come on up, and we'll do this kind of informally. We're not that formal here. This is not a court of law.
I think that this point is wonderfully raised, and had contemplated having an enhancement, a criminal enhancement position for those situations not covered by people who already have a felony conviction. And we might consider, well, having an amendment, or since we have a one topic rule in our legislature, having an additional bill drop that addresses the penalty enhancement for similar to what we have in the current situation. And I do believe that I'm not sure if that's what Brian was thinking, but we often think similarly, so I wouldn't be surprised if that's what Brian.
Okay. Brian, yeah.
Hey,
don't fall over. I did that in Nordstrom the other day. Mr. DeLashman, comments?
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Association. For those of you who haven't seen me in that role, the Oregon Council of Police Association is approximately 3,300 line officers statewide, representing over 30 associations, police associations. We're in strong support of this bill. I just had two comments. One was a comment actually that Representative Lowe just mentioned. It's amazing how as you get into a hearing, all of a sudden a new issue comes up that you hadn't thought about before, and I think the penalty enhancement gets to the issue that is being raised, and I think actually is a very, very good suggestion. I'm surprised that all of the great minds in this room hadn't thought about that before we got here. The second piece, again, is a technical amendment, and I know that Representative Lowe has already raised the issue in an amendment that she's prepared, and it came out actually out of one of my members, and that's the issue of the narrowness of this being only ballistic proof. That's my understanding from some of the contacts I've had with officers, that in a lot of cases, non-ballistic vests or stab-proof vests are easily convertible to a ballistic-proof vest. And so I would like us to be very aware when we're going through the amendments that we deal with that issue. So you wouldn't have one felon in possession of a stab-proof vest and the other felon standing next to him that has the additional panel that makes it a ballistic vest, but yet you have no ability to go after the felon that's in possession of that particular vest.
All right. Thank you, Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I was curious after the discussion we've been having. I'm wondering if it would be kind of an appropriate to say that anyone who is carrying if you go into a bank and you have a gun and you have a vest on, there's an I think we could assume that you may plan to use that gun or into a store or any time. What if you, rather than the felon kind of a situation, anyone who in possession of a weapon who is committing a crime who has a vest would be, I don't know how that would fit with the right ACLU concept of being able to wear a vest, but I think just saying a felon can't wear a vest, if he's not doing anything, maybe he just wants to protect himself. But if you have a weapon, there's a possibility you plan to use that weapon. I don't know. I'm not making...
No, you're making... I understand where you're going. But I've kind of got a disjointed mind anyway, so...
Well, you fit right together there. As long as the joints come together.
We do.
Senator Duncan, in response to that, I think that really goes back to the use of non-lethal weapons that was mentioned earlier. If you tie it directly to that person carrying or possessing a gun and the vest, you're not getting to the issue of the police officer's ability to use in situations where a gun may not be in the possession of the felon, but they're committing a crime, the ability to use non-lethal or bing bag or stun options to bring that person down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator, Mr. Chair, I think I would certainly agree with where Senator Courtney and Senator Duncan are going on this. I think what we might want to look at, based on those comments, would be some type of an amendment in which, if you are convicted of X amount of crime, and in the process of committing that crime, you were wearing one, then that would be the additional penalty. So it's not a matter of guessing whether someone's going to commit a crime, but they did actually commit a crime. And they were wearing one at the commission of that crime, then that would presume that penalty as well. And I think I would be very supportive of that.
Okay, one other issue that we need to think about as we're thinking about this is, Brian, you mentioned stabbing protection. I don't know where any of that's defined or how we would define that for the purpose, to the extent that we would be able to articulate that in a court of law, that this particular article of clothing is, in fact, what the legislature meant to prevent someone from wearing.
Chairman Minnis, I've been thinking about that for several days, too, and I know that the amendments that I suggested to Representative Lowe specifically states, say, stab-proof, I think there may be another legal term that we could use. I was thinking in terms of maybe ballistic armor or armor easily converted to ballistic armor may be a better legal way to catch that particular piece that I was raising.
I would be interested in the legislation that was enacted in California and the other jurisdictions to see what they came up with as to whether or not there might be some benefit from looking at that. The other gentlemen at the table who have not spoken, do you have something you'd like to say?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Minnis. My name's Sheriff Bob Wolf, Polk County Sheriff. The issues of, you know, maybe looking at this and changing it to address the issues of a person actually committing a crime is almost a little bit behind the fact, because the issue for law enforcement is that we're going to get engaged in a serious situation with them, and our issues are, as we've seen nationally on some highly televised news broadcasts, is that we get engaged and happen to deploy deadly force on the individual, and they're wearing body armor, and so you end up with a longer firefight in a situation such as that.
Of course, not to get argumentative with you or anything like that. I mean, it seems to me that a Class C felony for unlawfully wearing body armor in the midst of a firefight where you literally have attempted murder or murder charges or much more serious charges, to me that's sure. It's kind of a moot issue. I mean, it's way beyond. I mean, thinking in my experience as a law enforcement officer, where it might be much more practical is where an officer does a stop and talk, or you're stopping mere conversation, chatting
right.
with somebody, you notice that they in fact have this stuff,
right.
and you know it progresses from there. You might be able to prevent that, and you might be able to I guess then look for that kind of defensive tool being used by certain individuals that you believe to be prone to commit crime. So I mean, there are other applications too, I think, in terms of preventative measures law enforcement can take. The firefight thing is an obvious problem, but...
Well, certainly our position would be that, you know, we'd rather the felons not have it in their possession. If you stop and look at why it was originally manufactured and designed, it was designed for military and police personnel and other safety personnel that actually have to go out and put their life on the line, and often they're in harm's way. It's also designed to fit, you know, police officers under uniforms to try to be more concealable. So I think the emphasis on why it was originally designed was not for the general public's use, but for those individuals that have to go out and put their lives on the line.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Another way to approach this, and I tend to agree with the chairman, I'm not a police officer, but I can fully understand that, you know, that it would have limited ability to deter. What you're after is somebody not having it in the first place. Have you thought about perhaps including some of the violent misdemeanors, which might reach a few more people who you have to worry about, especially since sometimes things are plea bargained down? Did you give thought to that when you were drafting? Because I know the violent misdemeanors are covered in the prohibition against having firearms, or maybe they're in there anyway.
Hi, Chairman and Senator Burdick. I think that as we think the process through and develop this concept in light of this very fruitful discussion that we're having today, crimes against persons are exactly, people commit crimes against persons are exactly the kind of individual that we would not want to possess body armor if they wish to continue with their criminal enterprise.
And Mr. Chairman, there's an existing list of people out there who are not just convicted felons who are not allowed to legally purchase firearms in Oregon, and that might be a place to start. And it's violently mentally ill, violent misdemeanors, convicted felons, and perhaps that might be a place to start.
Mr. Chairman,
I just want to ask one.
Be careful to target exactly the population that's concerned with and not impair the rights of our public citizens.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, one more
question.
Yeah, could you help me? I don't know. I have one of these vests. It was given to me as a joke after the 97 sessions. A used one. And I don't even know how to, I would not turn it, I'd probably put it over my head or put it on my tuck back, my rear end. I don't even know how to put the thing on. But the purchase of these, are these easy to come by? Are they? Is this pretty much an exclusive item that's only manufactured very narrowly and only purchased by law enforcement types? I mean, how available are this, is this kind of vest? And I don't know whether you want to call it a bulletproof vest or a, I guess, soft body armor. However is the proper way to describe it. How available are they in the open market?
Anyone?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Courtney, I know you can order them off the Internet. That's the way we order them for our office. And I have seen them at garage sales. So, you know, an officer who is a reserve and has to buy his own vest may end up selling them after he retires in a garage sale, something like that. So they are fairly available. There's no question on the order form on the when we purchase through the Internet on whether or not you're a felon or anything like that. Actually, it's legal in Oregon anyway, so they wouldn't need to ask that question.
No questions asked. Under 21 drinking, or I don't even want to get into that other area. I don't even want to mention the other area around here. No question. Just sell it any way you can. Get the money. Go. Minors, elders, seniors, anybody gets it. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Comments from the gentleman? Anything? Okay. I've got one other witness from the District Attorney's Association. Katie Suver, is that correct? Katie Suver? Is this the Oregon District Attorney's Association? Is that correct?
Chairman, my name is Katie Suver. I'm with the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I'm here to give the District Attorney's Association support of this particular bill. In light of the comments that have been made, if I could take a moment to respond to a few things from the point of view of a district attorney and what we typically see on a daily basis. First of all, I wanted to address the limiting suggestion, limiting it, that is, to people who have been previously convicted of violent felonies. As most of you are aware, the number of times that police officers are put in dangerous situations are, for example, when they're serving search warrants. These are usually done when they're serving them for drug houses or other things like that. Felony possession, delivery, and manufacture of a controlled substance, all of those are non-person crimes. That means they are considered under the sentencing guidelines as nonviolent felonies. And so if we were to limit it to only persons who had been convicted of previous person felony crimes, then there is a risk that we are losing that main target area which I think all police officers would agree when they're serving search warrants, there can be 15, 20, 25 police officers using very high security and high risk, treating it as a high risk situation. And I would suspect that if we were to look at some of the police officer shootings in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other areas, we would find that, in fact, those occurred when the police officers were dealing with subjects who were attempted to be arrested during the course of a drug stop or something related to drugs. Other crimes which are actually considered nonviolent crimes are also burglary. Some burglaries can be considered violent crimes or person crimes, but a lot of them are not. Entering a dwelling only to commit the crime of theft, if there was no one in the home, would be considered a non-person burglary, or entering a building, the same kind of thing. A felon in possession of a firearm is considered a non-person felony, that is a non-violent felony. And so for those reasons, I think that it's probably safe to say, although we haven't seen any language, that the District Attorney's Association would probably be in opposition to limiting it only to violent felonies or person felonies. The second issue was the possibility of expanding the language of the bill. And I think that the notion at the time was to, as someone previously indicated, address situations where people obviously have already engaged in conduct and have been convicted as felons. Indeed, this could actually be a new statute, which is simply defined much like unlawful possession of a firearm as unlawful possession of body armor, and included in there a provision that indicates that it would be unlawful for someone to possess body armor during the commission of a crime. And that would probably get us to the situation where we're talking about people who haven't had a prior felony conviction, but certainly are using the body armor in that particular circumstance in order to gain an advantage toward the police officers. There was another interesting point that someone brought up about transporting people in custody, and I think there could be an exception that would be made, obviously, if the person was in police custody at the time, regardless of their felony convictions or felony record, that they would be allowed for that purpose to possess or wear body armor. And if there aren't any more questions, that was all I had to say.
Question, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I just zoned out. What point did you reach on the notion of people who use body armor in the commission of a crime? Did you? I just zoned out for a second. You just do you believe that there should be enhanced penalties?
Chair Minnis, if I can, Senator Burdick, I think that if we were to, if there was a proposed new law as opposed to amending the crime of felon in possession of a firearm to include felon in possession of body armor and instead make it a crime unlawful possession of body armor, the statute itself could be written to include it would be unlawful to possess body armor during the commission of a crime. And obviously there would be elements that would have to be proven in order to prove that crime, namely that someone wasn't just walking down the street or that they weren't stopped for a traffic infraction. It would have to be for the commission of a crime. And I hope that answers your question.
No, but what I'm trying to get at is, what would that get you? I mean, in the real world of prosecuting, what would that get you? If the person's committing a crime and they're also wearing a vest on the ground, how much difference would that make in terms of how they're actually prosecuted?
I suppose it would, excuse me, Chairman, Senator Burdick, I suppose that it would depend on the degree to which it was categorized, if indeed it was made a felony. And again, if I'm understanding your question correctly, it's how, to what degree would that be considered a serious crime? Felon in possession of a firearm is a Class C felony, obviously subject to sentencing guidelines, but it is at a high enough ranking on the sentencing guidelines that for the majority of people who we see having committed that crime, their criminal history score is serious enough to where their presumptive sentence is one of prison as opposed to probation. And again, because this crime would potentially be subject to sentencing guidelines, the person's prior criminal history would be taken into account. And if they were, for example, committing a misdemeanor while in possession of body armor and had no prior criminal history, assuming there weren't aggravating factors, their presumptive sentence would be probation. Nonetheless, they would then have a felony conviction preventing them from possessing body armor in the future.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Anybody out in the audience want to speak on the issue? Ingrid, would you like to come up again, or are you pretty much done with this?
No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Delashman.
Again, Brian Delashman, Oregon Council of Police Associations. There was one additional thought that I would bring up. It's buzzing around behind you back here about one additional issue, and I'll just throw it on the table. The possibility in the issue of a domestic violence situation that you establish that as an affirmative defense rather than trying to deal with it any other way, so that if somebody, a woman was in fear because of a domestic situation, was a felon, then was caught in this trap, that would be an affirmative defense to this particular statute.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. I think what I'm going to do is taking some notes here. I'll kind of put together a little work group on this Senate Bill 133. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 133, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 141. And let's see, did you sign up first or last, Ingrid?
And I apologize for the confusion. I certainly didn't mean to come up first on the previous bill. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do support Senate Bill 141. In fact, we proposed this bill. Last session, the legislature passed the enhancement for assault fours, causing an assault in the fourth degree to become a felony if it was committed in the presence of children. And the idea, obviously, was to protect children, if possible, from seeing and hearing their parents or other adults engaged in that behavior in their presence. It didn't occur to us at the time, and so we didn't raise this at that time. But technically, the language as passed would make it a felony for one child in a home to commit a misdemeanor assault on another child in the home if there were other children present. So fights between children in the home were inadvertently, I believe, covered by this measure. And there have been juvenile prosecutions based on this felony, because obviously some prosecutors reading that language felt that it was the legislature's prerogative to decide that even those kinds of incidents in the home in front of other minor children were intended to be covered. When the bill was drafted, it came back in this form, and after looking at it, a legislative council brought to my attention the fact that by amending it in this fashion, you would also be limiting application of the felony to young adult parents. So if you were 17 and a parent, if you use this amended language, it would exempt you from this felony treatment. That was not our intention. So I have drafted, and I'm sorry, I just have my own handwritten, engrossed version of the bill, but what this would do would be to say, if you're a 17-year-old parent, and you commit a misdemeanor assault in the presence of your child or stepchild, then it does become a felony assault. But if you are under the age of 18 and otherwise engage in misdemeanor assault in the home, that it is not a felony to do that. Misdemeanor assaults, basically, as most of the committee is aware, involve the infliction of physical injury, and physical injury is defined in Oregon statute. Starts at a very low level. It includes some injuries which are significant, but it also includes some very minor injuries, cuts, abrasions, significant pain. That kind of thing qualifies as a physical injury.
Thank you.
So So it's our view that it should not be a felony for one child in the home to inflict a physical injury such as a cut, scratch, bloody nose on another child in the presence of yet a third child.
Questions? Senator McCordy.
I'm sure I'm the only one here that doesn't understand this in terms of what you just said. So if I'm 17 and I'm a parent and I commit an assault that's a misdemeanor in the presence of, I'm guilty of a felon.
You can be adjudicated as a juvenile for a felony. It's not guilty of a felony crime, but you could be adjudicated on a juvenile felony.
I thought you were going to treat a 17-year-old in one circumstance differently than a 17-year-old in another based on the basis of the fact that they're a parent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Crittenden, exactly. So the amendment does
and
that.
And one would be guilty of a felony. Excuse me. Let me just use my simplistic approach, otherwise I'll lose it mentally. It's one is it's strictly on the basis of parenting. Is that correct? That's what you use. Use the word that one's a parent, one's not a parent.
That's correct, Senator Crittenden. And that is only because of our desire to preserve the intention of the original measure, which was to prevent parents, even young parents, from committing acts of domestic violence in the home in the presence of children.
You know, that's interesting. That doesn't bother you constitutionally, what you just said.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, I think there's a rational distinction. I think as a parent you have other obligations than you have as a child in the home.
But a child, the 17-year-old is still a child for purposes of this discussion. I'm not trying to argue. I'm just into the constitutional thing. If you say it's okay and the other Supremes say it's okay, then it's okay. But I don't want to see us pass a statute out of here which all of a sudden gets thrown out by one of the appellate courts on the basis that, you know, it's not equal protection of the law. It doesn't, you know, that's all I'm trying to do. And it may all be perfect, and the distinctions that you say are rational are all there. It's just escaping me at this very moment, at this very time in my life. That's all I'm going to say. So if I didn't mean to be difficult, Ms. Swenson or Chair Minnis, I didn't mean to be difficult.
I think it's helpful because I get confused a lot. Any other questions? Senator Burdick.
Well, two questions. One is, did you give any thought to just lowering the age to 16, just for example, to cover basically children who are essentially physically grown as well as parents?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, no, we didn't discuss that. Partly because we were just talking, I think our bill was directed at juvenile court jurisdiction and how to affect juvenile court jurisdiction, which basically applies to anyone under 18. So we did not give thought to that.
The second question is, it looks from this amendment, and I hope I'm not just being dense here, but it looks the amendment is everyone's child covered here? For example, if it's a child of the victim, is it covered by your amendment? I have some questions about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the way I structured the amendment was to cover in paragraph C persons who are under 18. So I took out that person's child. And then so as to cover that with both with respect to persons under 18 and others, added a separate paragraph with respect to one's child. So that applies to all parties.
I see. Got it.
Questions, clarifications?
Is there an amendment?
Additional answer. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ingrid. Appreciate it.
Sure.
And now we have Gina Skinner from the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Chair Minnis, my name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a deputy district attorney, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We oppose this bill for a number of reasons. I think that it's been pretty much articulated by the last speaker what the issues are, primarily under sentencing guidelines. For those of you who are not familiar with sentencing guidelines, they are for adult crimes and the way adult crimes get characterized and sentenced. However, they take into consideration juvenile convictions, and they only take into, well, the adjudication, I'm using the word conviction loosely, but adjudications in juvenile court. They only consider, however, if it's a felony. juvenile adjudication. So if it's a misdemeanor, juvenile adjudication is not considered in sentencing guidelines. For example, if you had, if this was enacted and you had a person that had multiple misdemeanor assault four adjudications in juvenile court, once they became 18 years old and became part of the jurisdiction of adult court, those would never affect their sentencing guidelines once they became, say they were convicted of another assault in felony assault in adult court. So what we're primarily looking at, obviously, is the domestic violence situations, and we have a lot of parents of children who are under 18 years old. And we'd have a situation where you have, say, a 17-year-old parent with also a minor who is the mother of the child, and then they have a baby together. And if this was enacted, and they would be multiple misdemeanor assaults against the victim, once he became an adult, none of those could be used against him to enhance his sentence per sentencing guidelines when he became into an adult court. So that would be a concern for us. As far as the amendment that was mentioned by the last speaker, it is possible that we might not object to the basic premise of what she was speaking as far as sibling assaults. That isn't primarily what our concern is. We don't really focus on sibling assaults as much when we're charging these crimes. But I think that what Senator Courtney pointed out, it would be problematic, and that if it was overturned by the Supreme Court, then that exception would be taken out, and then we would go back to the law, which would be a misdemeanor, and so that would be a problem. I brought an example that is used in juvenile court to point out that this is a real situation as far as juvenile offenses, and we don't want to limit it to 17-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds. We have children that are as young as 12 and 13 and 14-year-olds that are having babies here, and I'm speaking primarily of Marin County, which is where I know anything about, but just recently we had a defendant who was 17, the victim was 16. They had been together for 3 years, so she was 13, he was 14 when they got together. While they were together, he was convicted of, adjudicated of an armed robbery, but they were still remained together. She tried to leave him. She began to have lots of accidents that her mother noticed with lots of bruises. She came to juvenile court and became noticed because she was trying to get emancipated, and that she tried to leave him, but then she got a head concussion and then became pregnant. And at that point, which is what is often occurs in these situations, that the mom, the stepdad of the victim here, made her move out of the home because they didn't want a baby in the house. They didn't want anything to do with her because she was not willing to get an abortion. So she had the baby and was then living with the defendant because she had nowhere else to go. So they're living in an apartment together. She's 16, he's 17, and they have a four-month-old baby. And at that point, he's not helping with the parental responsibilities. She mentions to him that she wishes that he would help out. And then he strikes her in the head and the face, slapping her, punching her, grabbing her hair, yanking her around, striking her on the head, pulling her hair, and the whole time she's holding the baby. And those are the situations that we see. And so we don't want there to be any chance that a person like this cannot be held accountable for that crime, so that when the next year, when he turns 18 and they're still together, they still got a child, she still has no support from her family, has nowhere to go, that can't be held as a juvenile person's felony to enhance his place on the sentencing guidelines grid, so that he could be potentially presumptive prison if that's where he needed to be.
Any questions? I've always thought we ought to have like beating squads that just go around and drag them out of their house and beat the living car out of them and just adjudicate it right then and there. That might be a problem.
Well, Chair Minnis, I suppose that you're in the position to be able to begin that if that's what you feel is needed.
Yeah. Senator Burdick.
So your only objection then to doing an approach like this to put parents into the, in other words, to make a special category for underage parents, your only objection to that is it might not be upheld as constitutional?
So you're talking about the amendment that was mentioned by the last speaker. And I can't, since I hadn't seen that draft previously, I can't commit that the District Attorney Association would support that specifically. But from my experience in our office as far as our charging decisions and what cases, we focus on the domestic violence situations, not on the sibling cases. But I do think that the wording of that may be problematic, and I wouldn't want there to be any possibility that these kind of situations could somehow slip through because of the difficulty in wording that distinction. And I also didn't want there to be, I think she had mentioned putting an age limit in there, and I think that's also problematic because there's always going to be someone younger that committed the same crime.
Okay. You got a question? Okay, I do have a question for you, and that has to go, the definition of in the immediate presence of, how's that being applied in terms of prosecutions?
Chairman, if I can only speak for my own county as far as how we have been applying it, there is no definition in the statute. I know that in the last legislature that we went forward and did create a specific definition for witness because we came up with this same problem in 99 we added that amendment. So it's always possible that if this committee, if that they see that as a problem that they want to create a definition, we would definitely be in support of helping you to with some language on that. However, as far as what we're considering, we're looking at specifically situations like what was mentioned in this case. Because what was happening in 1997 is you had minor children who were too young to be considered a witness, and so therefore they couldn't come to court and testify, and specifically babies that were being held. I've prosecuted both cases where victims were holding babies and they were being beaten, severely kicked, hit. I've also prosecuted a case where a defendant who was high on drugs was holding a baby and would not give the baby to the mother and was kicking the mom while holding the baby and ultimately ended up throwing the baby at the victim, and luckily she caught it. But those are what we are looking at is in the immediate presence of, is within the confines of the same room that they are there together. We've had cases where you've got young children, again, children that are too young to testify, that are like lying on a bed and they're standing on each side of the bed and they're yelling at her. He may throw a beer bottle, hit her in the head with it, but that child is in that immediate presence.
And those are the most obvious kind of cases. I certainly agree with that. But do you know if there are any cases where someone's been convicted under the statute where the child was, say, in an upstairs bedroom or another part of the home and could hear what was going on as opposed to seeing what's going on? I guess I'd like to have at some point some reaction to whether that's happened and prosecuted successfully and whether or not that's appropriate.
Chairman, again, I can only speak for our county, but our position is that we make a distinction between those two. So in the immediate presence of, we would define as in the confines of that room, and that that would be usually would be a younger child. But if we charged it as and convicted them under witness by a minor child, that one could either see it or hear it. But if they were to hear it, like if they were in another room or even upstairs, there's been a few of those, but I've done them, they would have to articulate to the police officer that when interviewed that not only did they hear an argument, but they heard an assault. And so that they had to hear something that was more than just yelling, because witnessing yelling is not a crime, but that they would have to articulate there was some kind of heard a threat. And then they heard a slam or a slap or a punch or heard something, and then come downstairs and see the victim, you know, holding a bloody nose. Something that we could piece together that what they were witnessing or hearing was in fact an assault.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, I wonder if it would be possible to ask Ingrid to come back up. Well, the two of them are right there, because I know they hadn't had a chance to see them. I wonder if she might have been able to respond, and we could hear their reaction while they're both right here. Would that be possible, Mr. Chair?
It's fine with me. Did you mind stepping down at this point, or do you want
to? Do
you want them both together?
Yeah, I think it would be helpful.
Okay. You guys promised to accidental each other?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the assault of two witnesses in the presence of each other.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan. As I listen to the witnesses' remarks, I certainly do not intend to have the effect that she seems to be concerned about. It is the sibling conflicts that we wanted to exclude, a child and parent conflicts in the home, those two categories, but certainly not in any case, the parent of a child.
Would it be possible to construct some language that makes it very obvious what you're trying to do?
And I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair, I may not have done that. I think what I did should accomplish that, but perhaps it doesn't, and I'd be more than happy to...
You're a lawyer, I'm not. I mean, I'm sure there's a certain syntax that goes along with the way laws are written, but I've often liked them to be written so that people like me can actually pick them up and read them, and it's on its surface appears to be...
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'd be happy to work on them.
And again, I'm not going to commit, but it sounds like something much more in line with what we would be in support of that after I saw the wording, that we would have an opportunity to review that and take it back to our committee. And I think it's possible that we might be able to resolve the issue on that point.
That's, Mr. Chairman, that's what I was hoping maybe the two of them even could work that out a little bit, because it sounded to me like they hadn't had a chance to connect, and maybe they could put it together so we could get together.
Mr. Prinz has a question that I'm going to have him ask you.
I was just going to ask if you, in your county, you prosecute children, for example, who do, youths who do assault the parent or sibling, and if that's an issue that you would support this being applied to that situation, or would it be more where Ingrid's saying just to a youth who has a child?
So you're asking that if we, in fact, do prosecute those children? Unfortunately, I work in the adult section of our office. I do not do juvenile crimes, so I couldn't give you a specific answer. I'm sure that we do. I'm not able to answer that question. And I guess the problem also, too, is that since I'm only from Marion County, even if I committed that we didn't, that I would be able to speak for the other counties, and they obviously would still be affected by this statute.
Senator Metzger has a question for you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My apologies. I was not on the committee last year when you did the bill, so maybe you could just provide some clarity to me as I look at this. One of the words in here is residing. I've always understood residing means they live there. Is that essentially right? So the way I read this, and please to tell me if I'm correct on this, and then if so, what the thought is behind this, because it has to be their child or residing in that home. So is that would be correct if, let's say, you had young parents, the 17-year-olds, or even older than that, I guess, under this circumstance, mm-hmm. but the man came home and they were married or they were living together and committed this assault on the woman in the presence of two minor children in which the woman was babysitting for her sister. That would not then qualify because they weren't her children and they weren't living there, even though they would witness this and were part of that extended family unit. Is that correct?
Chairman and Senator Metzger, that's correct. We do not prosecute crimes where we have a lot of situations where you may have a daycare situation or you've got the neighbor children that are overplaying.
Right.
When this goes on, they make great witnesses, but it does not make it a felony crime. It's only if they're living there. I think that was added to the bill to deal with situations where you have these extended families. You've got grandma that is taking care of the grandchildren because the parents are wherever and things are being witnessed. You know, you've got an aunt and uncle who have a niece and nephew that are living there at the home, you know, for the school year because the parents are, you know, whatever they're doing. And so that we wanted to not exclude them because then they are really have become a family member because
right.
they have a bedroom and they are living in that house.
I was just wondering, the thinking of that, because it seems to be a trauma for the child. This is one of the reasons you did this bill. And so it's just less traumatic if they're just, you know, their sister's child as opposed to the child of the person themselves, or...
I don't think that the trauma would be any less, and I'm sure that that came out of some kind of a compromise that came from the last session.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I think the idea was to get at family situations more than just the circumstance where children have to be present. I think it was targeted at families so as to discourage people in the family setting from using violence in front of children.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other questions, comments? Thank you. I appreciate your time. And then we're going to move to Senate Bill 156. We'll close the public hearing on whatever that other bill was. Senate Bill 141. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 156. And Joseph Felix, you're first up. Joseph Felix. You want to be last?
All right.
Bring up the entourage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'll have to excuse me. This is my first time testifying in front of the committee, and if you'll all bear with us. My name's Sean Cleave. I'm here on behalf of Senator Fisher, supporting Senate Bill 156. This bill pertains to an amendment that would include reserve officers under the aggravated murder charge. As far as Senator Fisher's office is concerned, the way we view this bill is that not including reserve officers under this definition of aggravated murder is can only be described as an oversight in the language of the law. I've brought forward Mr. Felix and Mr. Arwood and their associate to testify, so if it pleases the chair, I'll turn it over for them to testify.
Okay, that's fine. And just be sure and identify yourself for the record before you begin your testimony. That'll help me follow along. Who's going to start?
I will, Chairman.
Go ahead, sir.
Chair, Menace, and members of the committee. I'm Detective Joseph Felix. I work for the Winston Police Department in Winston, Oregon. Please bear with me. I have a couple of documents I need to give to you. One is a letter from my chief who regrets he's unable to attend today due to prior arrangement. I'll go ahead and read a correspondence that he gave me. He would like to read a correspondence that he gave me to read to the committee. Dear Honorable Committee members, in October 1999, two officers from the Winston Police Department went to a residence in Winston investigating a vicious dog complaint. The officers were requested to do so from the suspect who they attempted to contact earlier. Even before the officers arrival at the scene, the suspect became angry and was non-cooperative upon their arrival. The suspect, for no apparent reason, while talking to the officers, picked up a .30-30 rifle standing next to a sliding glass door and pointed it at Officer Roberts and fired the weapon. Officer Felix returned fire, and the suspect retreated upstairs and a short time later surrendered. The suspect was charged with various felonies, including attempted aggravated murder and attempted murder. In the court, the defense brought up an argument that it was not an attempted aggravated murder because the definition of peace officer only included full-time regular officers. Officer Roberts was a reserve officer and did not fall within the category as a full-time police peace officer. The presiding judge ruled in favor of the defense and dismissed the aggravated murder charge. Officer Roberts has received countless hours of training, not only with our department, but with the local reserve academy at Umpqua Community College. While I understand that Judge Milliken was referring to the letter of the law, I do not understand the logic in the definition of peace officer as pertaining to this case. Obviously, the suspect did not have any idea Officer Roberts was a reserve. By all accounts, the officer did not announce that they were reserve officers. They wear the same uniform, the same badge, they take the same oath of office, and are appointed with the same criteria. Reserve officers are often requested to perform, and find themselves in the same volatile circumstances as full-time officers. Mm-hmm. I urge you to give this bill careful consideration and allow reserve officers the same protection as law as their full-time counterparts. Sincerely, Chief Bruce Jones.
All right. Thank you.
Now, that was the correspondence from Chief Justice and Chairman Menace and Committee. Now I'd like to address you with a statement that I've prepared. Chair Menace and members of the committee, I would like to thank you, first of all, for this opportunity and honor to speak on behalf of the Winston Police Department. Back in October 3rd, 1999, Officer Roberts was involved in an incident that put in motion me speaking here today. Looking on that day, I can play back the events in my mind as they are occurring right now. I can see the suspect picking up the rifle, pointing it at Officer Roberts, and firing the weapon. I can still see the muzzle flash from the weapon and hear the report of the weapon as the suspect fired at Officer Roberts. After being shot at and taking cover, I asked Officer Roberts if he was okay. being uncertain if he was hit or not. I was not thinking of Officer Roberts as a reserve officer at that time, but as an officer that was just shot at. When Officer Roberts took his position as a reserve officer, he took an oath, the same oath I took when I was hired as a full-time officer. There is no difference between the oaths taken in either reservists or full-time officers. We raised our hand, and we swore to uphold the laws of the state and serve to protect the public. We wear the same uniform, we share the same fear, and regard each other as brothers in the law enforcement community. We share the same feelings in dealing with tragedy of loss of life, but yet we are viewed differently by the written word of law. And in the public eyes, reserve officers is looked at and viewed as the same as a full-time police officer. The public expects and even sometimes demands professionalism, service, and courage from the reserve officer, as we as fellow officers view them as professionals. Because of that day back in 1999, a trial came about. We gathered in the courtroom, sat and listened to a ruling that shocked everybody in the law enforcement community. We were told that there was a difference between a reservist and a full-time police officer when someone attempts to take their life. We were told that a person can take a reservist's life while he or she is working to protect and serve the public, and it was no different than if they killed a full-time police officer. The bottom line, they are not given the same protection as full-time police officers in our state. After hearing this ruling, I sat back and thought, why a reserve officer is viewed different. I thought of all the training they go through to perform the duties of a police officer. I recalled hours a reservist sat in the same classroom I did, studying and learning for his job so they can perform just as I do when protecting the public. After that ruling and trying to find a difference between Officer Roberts and I came up with one conclusion. There is no difference. We are the same and therefore should be treated the same. The public looks and views the reservist equal to full-time police officers, and in fact can't even tell the difference. There are no difference between the jobs we do when working to protect the public. Like I stated before, the public expects it, and I feel we should be treated the same. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next.
Mr. Chair, I'm Officer Arwood. I'm a reserve officer with the Roseburg Police Department. I'm here today to...
The Hillsborough Police Department?
Roseburg.
Okay, thank you.
Police Department, yes, sir. I'm here today to impress upon you the importance of the changes pertaining to the ORS definition of reserve officer in Senate Bill 156. Under the current statute, reserve officers are not protected under the law as a full-time officer is. Small rural police agencies throughout the state do not have the financial resources to afford full-time officers to fulfill the needs of the rural communities. Therefore, they highly depend on reserve officers to serve and protect the public. These officers perform the same duties as full-time officers and should be granted the same protection under the law. On October 3, 1999, an incident involving a reserve officer presented itself. Many of us questioned the legal findings of this incident. We consulted with professionals in the field of law enforcement. We spent many hours consulting with legislative counsel. Our questions as so far have resulted in only one answer. There doesn't seem to be a valid reason as to why the reserve officer is not protected under the law as a full-time officer. It seems to only have been an oversight when the definition was wrote.
Is that it? Thank you. Questions at all, anybody so far? Sir?
Chairman, honorable members of the committee, my name is Chris Roberts. I'm with the Winston Police Department. I come before you today not only as a law enforcement officer, but also as a semi-victim, I think, of the way the laws were wrote in accordance with this incident, because I was the individual that was shot at that particular date and time. My main statement to you, I think, is I'd like to see the legislation changed to where reserve officers have the same amount of laws that protect them as what protect a full-time officer. There's no physical difference to just look at a reserve officer from my department and a full-time officer and be able to see that, you know, one's a reserve and one's not. Most of the agencies in my immediate area have the same uniform policies. There's no visual difference. I would like to have brought more people with us today to give you kind of a a broader sample of people to talk to, but we were unable to, so I apologize for that right now.
Okay. Any questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, okay. I think you are well represented today. I'm impressed with the representation, and obviously you've been there, and it's good to hear from you and your colleagues, because I could see where it would be a frightening experience to have to go through that.
Thank you,
and then to find out that you aren't considered a real police officer. Yeah.
It seemed like a slap in
the face. Kind of a slap in the face, yeah. Understand.
So, Roberts, after this particular incident, how did your agency deal with it in terms of dealing with you and helping you with Luke?
My agency stood behind me 100%. I mean, they put me on an administrative leave from the agency for as long as I wanted, with a minimum of 2 weeks. They encouraged that I go to a psychiatric hearing, see if I had any problems that I didn't think that I had or that I thought I might have. Other than that, the agency has been behind me 100% as far as trying to get the legislative session with you today. I'm now working with the agency on a full-time, part-time basis, and the duties that they have me working at right now, when I was called yesterday and asked to be here today, my agency informed me that, just take off, go ahead and do whatever's necessary, take as long as it takes, and
okay,
see if we can get it changed.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Metzger, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to talk about a little different topic for a second on the bill. And anybody can participate here and inform me. On a reserve officer, for example, some reserve officers often have different types of employment. I'm just curious about when they're not acting in the role of a peace officer, what are some of the things that reserve officers may be employed at, or do they have other types of jobs? Or?
Chairman, Senator Messenger?
That's where it works.
Yeah. I'm sorry, sir. At the time of this incident, I was actually employed by the United States Postal Service as a mail carrier.
Okay.
Other reserves we have working for our agency right now are employed with, like, Fred Meyer. We have a reserve that's employed by a local lumber company. We all come from a very diversified background as far as our past, before we decided to go into law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
yes, go ahead, sir.
The point I was getting at, and I don't have the answer myself, but would be curious to find some information. I'm very concerned about public disclosure issues, and there's a and also in this bill, it puts reserve officers under the public disclosure category, in which people cannot find information. And one of my concerns would be, and I don't know the answer, and I'll try to find this out, unless one of you happens to have that, would be someone who was acting not in their peace officer role, but as a private businessman in some transaction, and information could not be gathered. I'd have difficulty with that from a public disclosure issue. Does anyone know in this group whether it would cover their other activities under that category?
Mr. Menace. Senator Metzger.
Yes.
Okay. If I understand correctly, what you're asking of us is there a difference than the civilian job versus the police job, and if information can be obtained by the private sector on the private job?
Right. I mean, if someone is involved in some fraudulent activity as an Amway salesman or something, they say, well, I'm also a reserve officer. You can't have access to that information. I mean, that's like you would with any other citizen. That's the concern I have.
Well, in order to become a reserve officer for our agency, and majority of the agencies, I cannot answer them, but for Roseburg, I can a little bit. They go through an extensive background check in order to be hired as a reserve police officer. The standards and the qualifications to be appointed as a reserve officer with the city of Winston are no different than being appointed as a full-time police officer with the city of Winston. There is no difference in the criteria, the physical standards, testing, amount of education, convictions of misdemeanors or felonies, those are still put in place.
Right.
The reserve officers that work for our department are maintained, not main, I should not use the word maintained, but they are close ties to them. And we, they know, they have guidelines, they got rules of ethics to follow, and they have, and if they violate them, they are disciplined.
Yeah. Just one final comment, Mr. Chair. I understand, I appreciate that. I tried to make myself totally clear. It's not always unethical conduct. You know, sometimes public needs information about contracting, and newspapers and others would want information about things totally unrelated to that. And I was just wondering if some of these procedures of disclosure, may be affected by that in other business activities of individuals.
I don't think that it would apply to anything other than what transpired during the course of their duties and scope of employment's the wrong word, but their duties as a reserve officer that arose out of those activities and nothing else, because I have no immunity or limitation on disclosure for something that occurs outside of my employment with the Portland Police Bureau. Anything I do in business outside of that, subject to whatever disclosure laws are relative to anybody else who's a private citizen. So,
yeah, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes,
ma'am. If I could just impress one last thing on the committee. That we feel that if the law is not changed to include reserve officers from protection of aggravated murder, that the backlash would discourage reserves, potential reserves, to enroll in a program that's invaluable to rural communities in Oregon. And one last thing, Senator Fisher has agreed to attach an amendment to Senate Bill 156 on behalf of the Department of Justice. The amendment should be prepared by the next hearing, and the Department of Justice will be presenting testimony at that time. I've distributed a copy of the amendment as it has been suggested to the Legislative Council, and the amendment will extend to the statute to cover off-duty officers and retired officers as well as reserve officers, and I have a copy of those amendments for...
Okay. If you'd provide those for the committee, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair.
We've got Senator Beyer in line, and then Senator Duncan, if you don't mind. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A concern that I have first came to mind, or not first came to mind, one concern I had, is whether or not this would change anything in the Workers' Compensation Department, and I'm reading the statute now for coverage of municipal volunteer personnel, and I guess I need to ask the question, do you currently cover your reserve officers? Because it says in the statutes that a city or counties or municipalities have to choose or may choose to cover or not cover for the purpose of workers' compensation. And I don't know if you can answer the that question or not.
Chairman Menas, Senator Fire.
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 Thank you.
Apologize. The Winston Police Department, if a reserve officer is acting in the scope of his duties, and while the scope of his duties is on patrol, working for the department, and is injured, he is covered by the department.
Just one more.
Yes, they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I guess I'd just like to, I think that would be the case in most municipalities and in most rural fire districts and volunteer firefighters, all of them that I'm aware of do cover their volunteers for workers' compensation. I guess I'd just like to make sure that if we were to change the definition, that we would make sure that there's no changes in this.
You don't want to mandate that they cover
I don't want to mandate that they're covered. I don't want to make sure that we're not creating any problems in that area.
What's the citation?
It was 656, Chapter 656, and 031 is the volunteer workers.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your time. Any other questions, Senator Duncan? Senator Fire, I guess that's one.
Hey, Fire.
It's easy to get them mixed up.
It's like the fifth day of session. It's like birding. Starts with a B.
Yes, it's my understanding, reading this, that this this would cover reserve officers even if they were in the course of doing their other job, for example, doing your postal job, if you were the victim of a crime. In that setting as well. Is that your understanding as well?
Our understanding of the law is that it only covers officers in the course of doing their job. That would exclude retirees as it is now. However, that was one of the amendments that the Department of Justice was going to be making for the next meeting.
So is it your understanding that under that amendment, then a reserve officer, no matter what they're doing, whether they're doing their other job or their reserve officer job, would then be covered all the time?
No. From my understanding, the amendment would only cover them under the law if somebody was acting upon the officer as retribution for something that they had done as a police officer. So if Mr. Felix was accosted by somebody who he had arrested priorly while he was off duty, then he would be covered. But just mishaps would not be covered under the law.
Well, let's get some clarification. You're talking about accidental death?
Yeah.
Well, that obviously wouldn't apply to aggravated murder.
This is crime.
But I think, Senator Burdick, I think you're correct. I think by virtue of the fact that they would be a reserve police officer, if they were subsequently murdered, then they would that death would come under the aggravated murder statute. It would not have to be in the course of some enforcement action, if I'm understanding this correctly. Senator Courtney?
Committee Counsel, can I ask a question? I had a similar question. It's my understanding that the law exists now in aggravated murder. And I'm reading from lines 3 and 4 on page 2. The victim was one of the following, and the murder was related to the performance of the victim's official duties in the justice system. I interpret that to mean, I need help here, that a police officer, even if the police officer is not on duty and they are killed, are they... This particular existing law, I'm not getting into it. You want to amend it, but I want to talk about this, where we are today. And that is not, we're not talking about a police officer in the line of duty for purposes of aggravated murder. Am I right or wrong, counsel?
I need to check that.
Okay. I'm not trying to confuse anyone.
I'm going to confuse it even more because, right. Because the police officer's commission, I think reserve police officer's commission, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they can take police action unless, of course, limited by local jurisdiction tells them not to. But I think their authority can be enforced anywhere within the borders of the state of Oregon 24/7. To the extent that they're doing an enforcement of some sort, off duty or on duty, would be covered based on.
Is that also true of a reserve officer?
Not now.
Oh, okay. I guess would they have to identify themselves? And you as a police officer, would you have to identify yourself?
I would hope not, because as a detective, I don't run around necessarily identifying myself in the course of my duties.
I did understand, Mr. Chair, today why you have such big, broad shoulders. I bet you've got your big old vest on right now.
Actually, I look like Danny DeVito when I put that puppy on.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm trying to get at is I think there's a different situation. If somebody got very, very angry at you for delivering their mail late and committed a crime, it would be like any other profession doing something that somebody didn't like and being shot. I think the intent of the underlying statute is to draw a distinction between peace officers and other kinds of profession that do not on a daily basis put themselves in harm's way. So I guess that's what I was getting at here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, if I could, I'd like to invite the testimony of Kevin Neely. He's from the Office of the Attorney General, and I think he might be able to clarify that question.
Being the chairman of the committee, sure. I get around some stuff. We're not going to do that for the purpose of time today, but let me go to Senator Duncan real quick. I'll get his question. I've got a few other people I want to get preliminary testimony on, because this is just public hearing.
Sure.
And we can make all the mistakes we want, and we're going to go back in a little room at some point and try to figure out what in the world we did wrong or right and put it all together. Senator Duncan.
Yeah, I guess I just would like to raise the question, so when you're researching a little bit, let's say he is delivering mail. Someone pulls a...